Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to our weekly edition of On Politics, our inside show with our guests of Journal Sentinel hosts and reporters. I'm your host, Greg Borowski, and we'll tell you what's on our lineup this week. First, we'll look at how Scott Walker, who these days is feeling at home in Iowa. We'll get the latest on that pesky John Doe investigation back home in Wisconsin. We'll look at whether the Bucks will soon have a new home. And we'll talk about what's happening at the Capitol, where we have a new Supreme Court Chief Justice, or maybe we have two Supreme Court justices. And then, as always, we'll take reader questions. So if you're watching live, please send some of those questions in. And we'll get started in Iowa with a conversation about Scott Walker and presidential politics that we taped yesterday. We're joined now by Patrick Marley from our Madison Bureau, and on set we have Dave Umhafer, a PolitiFact Wisconsin reporter and longtime government reporter. Patrick, I'd like to start with you on the governor's visit last weekend to Iowa's and the Faith and Freedom Coalition Forum. You were out there covering that. What was the reaction to the crowd to Governor Walker's message?
Sure. Governor Walker was there with eight other likely presidential candidates or declared candidates, and all of them were talking about many of the things they talk about in their stump speech, maybe emphasizing some social conservative issues or some religious issues. In fact, at one point, Governor Walker read from a devotional that he says he and his wife, Tanette, read from daily. And so he was well-received, but that said, all of the candidates were well-received. It was different from his Freedom Summit that he did in January, where you could really feel this intensity from the crowd that he was this new thing that they were seeing for the first time, and they really came to him. At the Faith event, he did well, but I would say all of the other eight did very well, too, and there was no sort of breakout or standout speaker in terms of crowd reception that I saw.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it, Patrick, because I think often we look at it through the lens of how is Governor Walker doing, and he's obviously in this field of candidates who are playing off each other. And, I mean, how did his message differ, if at all, from the other candidates, and what does that say about what he may be trying to go for in terms of the electorate?
So the speech that he gave was mostly in keeping with the stump speech that he's been delivering for a month or two around the country. And the only deviation was when he talked about, and it was a substantial little detour, where he talked about this thing that happened on the right before his recall, where a woman got in touch with him after the recall to say that this guy had met him just before the recall, was very excited to vote for him in the recall, and then had had a heart attack a day before the recall. And the governor went back and looked at the devotional for that day, and he found the words to be very much meaningful about this experience that this woman had in the death of this man. And so he read from that, and he told this long story about that and read from that. So, he's the son of a preacher. He's able to connect with a crowd when you're talking about faith issues. But all of the candidates had very personalized stories. Ted Cruz was out there talking about things that he's defended in the courtroom for religious freedom issues. So each of them were trying to find a way to reach the audience, and they did. But I don't know that Governor Walker reached them any more than any of the other eight.
Okay. Well, let's talk, Dave. You've been looking at some of the polls in Iowa and elsewhere. We've talked about his opinion, his job approval ratings here in recent weeks, but what matters most right now for him on the presidential front is how he's doing in Iowa and New Hampshire. What did you find in those numbers?
This latest poll in Iowa was very interesting. Walker led, of course, 23%. Marco Rubio was at 13% and Jeb Bush at 12%. But on the favorability rating, which is what percentage people view him favorably, he also led. That was 59%. But Rubio was right there at 53%. So you're seeing a little bit of dynamic between those two developing. In recent weeks, if you go back to February, it's interesting. When Mitt Romney decided not to get in the race, he said, hey, there's a new generation of leaders who might be better to defeat a Democrat. And Walker was asked about that and singled out Rubio as a great choice. Now, you know, forward to this time, and they got into a little tangle this over the last couple days over whether governors are ready to lead on foreign policy on day one. So, you know, that's something to watch for coming forward is how those two interact. But some more from the poll. Among Tea Party voters, they weren't that prevalent in the poll in Iowa, but Walker easily led on favorability among Tea Party voters. Among non-Tea Party voters, it was interesting. Mike Huckabee had the highest favorability rating, and Huckabee also did well overall in the favorability with 57% higher than Rubio. So he's a force to be reckoned with in Iowa, at least. So,
yeah, Patrick, did you pick up anything from the voters in Iowa in terms of that, you know, there's that frequent dynamic of the governors have the executive experience, the senators have more of the foreign policy experience. Do the voters matter much, or what was your sense of what they were looking for?
The feedback that I've gotten from voters in Iowa, from Republican voters, is that they understand that a governor is not going to have the foreign policy experience of others, but they feel like that's something that can be learned. Governor Walker has focused a lot in the last couple months in talking about foreign policy and feeling more confident in talking about that. He talks a lot at the end of his stump speech about the importance of Israel as an ally and really goes against Obama and links Clinton in there as to what he considers poor policy, foreign policy decisions and not an aggressive enough stance against radical Islamic terrorism. That stuff really excites audiences at the number of events that I've been both in Iowa and New Hampshire that people really respond to that. And so I think they think that when they see that, that he's a guy who can learn the ropes, and they seem to give him some ground in terms of being able to learn that stuff if he doesn't know it yet.
Well, let's talk briefly about a couple other Walker-related developments in the news. One, there was a story out today, I believe, on how he's capturing some of the big money donors in the party. That's obviously a good thing. And the second story was a New York Times one this week on his strategy, apparent strategy of playing from behind, which the Brewers can certainly identify with this year. That may be Ron Reneke's managing Walker's campaign on the side. But any thoughts on those, Dave? I mean, what does it show for how Walker's doing?
Sure. That New York Times piece, I mean, to me it seems like Walker's just playing the perception game. He knows he can't outraise Jeb Bush in the early going here. So, you know, why try to get into a race you can't win? On the other hand, the governor seems well-positioned with donors nationally. And look at this New York Times story. He and Jeb Bush are the focus of the story. So he's right in there with the guy who's leading the race in terms of dollars.
Right, yeah. Well, that alone's a victory of sorts, right, too, if you frame that race around just those
yep.
two. So let's turn a little bit now to the John Doe investigation, which, you know, still is lingering out there. It's not quite put to rest or moving forward. Jason, there was some interesting back and forth over the weekend when the governor addressed it quite directly in Iowa. Can you describe what was said and what the significance of that is?
Sure. So the National Review had a story last week that described in detail some of the raids that occurred in the two investigations of people affiliated with Governor Walker. And he was asked about that on a conservative radio station on Friday. And the governor, who's largely been silent about the investigations for some time, lashed out and said that he thought there were constitutionally questionable things about the tactics that prosecutors had used and called it a political witch hunt, which is a phrase that he's used before and a lot of other conservatives have used. On Saturday, I wrote something about that, and I asked the district attorney in Milwaukee County, John Chisholm, and the special prosecutor, Fran Schmitz, about that. They both put out very strong statements. In fact, Chisholm contended that Walker could potentially be charged under the criminal defamation case, under criminal defamation law, saying that he knows enough of the facts to know that it wasn't a political witch hunt, that it was a bipartisan group of prosecutors who engaged in this, that it was judges who oversaw everything. He's in subsequent statements said that characterizing these events as raids is inaccurate because they were lawfully executed search warrants. This is all very unusual because Chisholm throughout this has been largely silent, hasn't really talked publicly about these matters, and he's really in recent days come out with a quite aggressive rhetorical stance on this.
Yeah, I think that was most interesting from the rhetorical aspect of it, because clearly I don't think Chisholm is going to charge Walker or pursue that, and it's sort of a irony of the free speech issue, and then can you speak about it? But Dave, let me touch on with you before we close. This issue is still lingering out there. In Wisconsin, we may be tired of hearing about it. Nationally, some people may have or may not have. Do you think this is something that Scott Walker is worried about still blowing up, or does he feel this is in the rearview mirror and moving forward?
Well, I'm sure he's got some concerns about it, but you also have to wonder, and maybe Patrick has thoughts on this too, whether it plays out well for him among conservatives who see this as a witch hunt, and maybe there's some sort of martyr points in this for him, where he's been the subject of this 4 or 5 year investigation, and maybe it garners him some sympathy.
Yeah, do you have a take on that, Patrick?
I think that's certainly true. You know, one of the things that makes Governor Walker appealing nationally is the recall and the attempt to pull him out of office because his opponents didn't like where he was going policy-wise. And to that, this investigation can feed into that narrative of, as Dave put it, as a martyr. I think people like that. This case still has to be decided by the state Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering whether to accept a challenge to the way the probe was conducted. How those things play out ultimately will have an effect on this race for president. You know, it's potentially more information will come out through this litigation. Potentially, he will be vindicated. Potentially, this whole thing could be restarted. That looks like only a remote chance, but it is feasible.
All right. We'll leave it there. So thanks to Dave and Patrick.
Thank you.
All right, we're back live and joined now by Don Walker, a longtime reporter who's working for us covering the arena issues on a fellowship through Marquette University Law School. We got a lot of news on the arena front today, or prospectively even more news, with the governor getting engaged in the discussions later today. Can you give us the latest, Don? Is today the day, or are we close to the day?
Well, it is a big day for the Bucks. They, of course, have a playoff game tonight, but more to the point on the arena financing, in a matter of hours, Governor Walker will convene a meeting of really A-lister elected officials, Mayor Barrett, County Executive Chris Abley, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, and Senate Majority Scott Fitzgerald, as well as the Milwaukee Bucks, last but not least, Bucks President Peter Fagan. I'd be a little surprised if we have an announcement today, and I say that only because of the complexity of the matter. There's an awful lot of turf to go over, lots of issues to discuss, but what I'm being told is really the purpose of today's meeting is to hear the governor tell the city and the county, this is what we're doing on the legislative side of things. What is it specifically that the county and the city can do to complete this package and get this arena built?
Well, one of the complexities we're dealing with, of course, is the level of public support for whatever they do. And about 2 weeks ago, we had a poll from Marquette Law School. It showed on a particular proposal from the state, something like 70% opposed. And now we'll put on the screen a couple numbers from a poll this week, which give a very different picture. This was from the Association of Commerce poll. And the respondents were asked, is it better for Wisconsin if the Bucks stay or leave? And 64% came down as stay. And if on a more general question of support or oppose a new arena, there were 67% who supported it. So, Don, who do we believe here? What's going on with these polls and how the questions were framed?
Well, I think if you look at the polls, and first with the Marquette poll, perhaps you might conclude that maybe it wasn't specific enough, and so it guaranteed maybe a negative outcome in terms of people responding to it. On the flip side, the MMAC poll was really front-loaded with a lot of preparatory sort of explanations saying this is how the arena financing plan will come together. It looks like it's something that could do a lot of good for downtown Milwaukee, so what do you think? So you have to sort of wade through that. Legislators that I've talked to said neither poll necessarily changed their mind. But obviously, I think the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce poll was all about changing hearts and minds and maybe the conversation to try to convince people that this is a good thing.
Well, let's bring in Jason Stein now from Madison. And Jason, I mean, some of the most important constituents now are those state lawmakers. Have you noticed any change in their views on state support, or is their line kind of drawn and it's more of a local issue here for what the city and county can and will do?
Well, look, I mean, I think you have to look at it from the standpoint that leadership both Democratic and Republican, I think, would like to see something happen. You know, no one wants to be cast as the party that lost a professional sports team for the state, particularly when it's doing a little better than it has been. But at the same time, there's also a lot of skepticism from, you know, outstate lawmakers, people that represent voters far away from Milwaukee, to say we, the taxpayers of Wisconsin, are going to, you know, assume risks, provide money for, you know, a team that is, again, you know, hours away in many cases from lawmakers in their districts, and is owned by billionaires as well.
Yeah, well, one difference, I think, at least in the tone, and Don, you would remember this from the Miller Park debate. I mean, at that time we had Tommy Thompson with this sort of infamous ticket to Milwaukee comment out there, and just as we had Walker saying, no, this is an issue. Everyone should care about the future of the Bucks.
Yeah, he played one card, I think, yesterday that was very important, Governor Walker, that is. And he was clearly reaching out to the people who live upstate. He said, hey, you should be paying attention to the fact that if this doesn't happen, not only do you lose some revenue from these NBA players who pay these income taxes when they play here in Milwaukee, but don't forget the fact that we're stuck with the Bradley Center. And if the Bradley Center is to stay and there's no new arena, Governor Walker reminded everyone, the state is on the hook for perhaps as much as $100 million or more in needed renovations over the next, say, 5 or 10 years, making the case that that's maybe something the taxpayer would not want to have. So why not make this investment, in his eyes, toward a new arena?
Yeah. Well, let me ask this question of both of you, starting with Jason. So if you had to name one, you know, so what's the biggest impediment, either in terms of an issue or a person or an entity? Who do you think is the holdup right now in closing this financial picture to get the final agreement in place? Jason,
well,
what do you think?
The holdup is the money. You know, the holdup is the money. Everyone here is trying to position themselves as best as possible. At the end of the day, look, I mean, I think you have not seen in years Democrats and Republicans at this high level meeting in person to try and solve any issue at all in years, really. So I don't really see anyone holding this up. I see people of both parties trying to thread a needle that is very, very difficult to do.
Well, Don, do you have a take on that? I mean, the governor is engaged now. We've heard everybody's cards are kind of on the table except the county. I mean, what do you expect the county could or would do to help, you know, close that gap?
Well, what I'm being told is County Executive Chris Abley has a couple of options here. One, he's got the land. He's got the Park East corridor that holds the potential for all this additional development the Bucks hope one day will come to fruition. Secondly, I know he's been talking, and I have been reporting this, that he has been talking to the Wisconsin Center District. For those not familiar with that district, that's the Convention Center and the Milwaukee Theater and the UW-Milwaukee Panther Arena. That outfit controls four separate taxes that are collected now that are used for debt service on those buildings. I think Chris Abley is thinking, is there a way to tap into that and provide some additional capital that could be diverted toward the arena? It's a talking point. It may not necessarily fly with Republican legislators, but I think Jason is right. The money issue is tops. And I asked Governor Walker yesterday flat out, well, what about the owners? Are they prepared to put in more money perhaps? Sources tell me the Bucks are not budging beyond their $150 million commitment, but we'll see.
All right, well, let's ask one last question on this. It should be an easier one. Do the Bucks win or lose tonight? Don?
I say it'll be a tight game. It'll be a lot of energy, and the Bulls win game six.
Okay. Jason, you got anything for us? Give us hope for the Bucks.
Going with Don on that.
All right, I'm going with the Bucks just because someone has to support the home crowd. We're going to shift now to our next topic, which is a very busy week in Madison. We've got action on the speed limit. We've got issues with the Supreme Court Chief Justice. And today, Jason, there's a lot of talk about lobster, crab, and shrimp, and I gather that's not because it's on the menu in the Capitol cafeteria. Can you tell us about this issue with food share that's being debated?
Right. So, we've got several proposals on public benefits that are happening right now at the Capitol, both inside and outside the state budget. You know, we've got requirements proposed to mandate that people have drug testing. Certain, able-bodied adults without kids have drug testing for benefits. You've got other possibilities of changing or, requiring additional types of food that can and can't be purchased for food, using food stamps under the food share program. So you've got these multiple proposals. They have a good chance of passing the legislature and being signed by the governor. But you have to remember, too, that there's a lot of federal involvement in these programs. And so a lot of these things, they'll generate huge debate, huge controversy. And at the end of the day, in many cases, they won't move forward.
Do you think on this one, will the Fed step in and prevent some of this? Or have these things been allowed in other states and it's a case where it can be put in place but may just have a minimal actual impact?
Well, the short answer is no and yes. There are several different programs here. There's jobless insurance, there's Medicaid, there's food share. So a whole range of programs. In general, the federal government hasn't allowed this sort of thing in terms of the drug testing, but there are some exceptions to that rule. Particularly in the area of unemployment insurance, but they're pretty limited.
All right, let's talk about this, the state Supreme Court, where we had the measure pass earlier this month that allowed a vote of the justices to choose the chief justice rather than just seniority. And so they did just that the other day, and they chose Patience Rogensack. And Shirley Abramson says, no, I'm still the chief justice. So, Jason or Don, who's the chief justice, and what will it take to get this issue resolved?
Well, Jason, is this an Al Haig moment? I'm in charge here. I wonder, Shirley, of course, is trying to keep a 126-year-old tradition going. She's going to court. As Greg just said, we have a new chief justice by virtue of an email vote. It's pretty tense over there, isn't it?
Well, I think the long-term hope of the people that pushed through the legislature this plan to foster more civility on the court is that it would do that by letting the justices choose their own leader, which they have done. But again, the reality is that the former chief justice has a federal lawsuit now. I think we could all probably agree that in general, lawsuits don't bring people closer and foster collegiality. I would think with a lawsuit going on, there would be some concerns about all sorts of even just simple conversations. I think, in the long term, if this proposal happens, the court may operate more smoothly, because the conservative majority on the court will no longer have a liberal chief justice to contend with and will be able to impose its will a little more effectively. But in terms of in any kind of foreseeable future, a more civil and collegial court, it remains to be seen, but it seems very difficult at this point.
Well, it seems like the approach, if it was to drive a more civil and collegial court, is sort of the old we burn down the village to save it kind of thing, because it's certainly not going to be very collegial as they battle over, who's got the leadership on a given day. Mm-hmm. And I mean, does it really, at some level, though, Jason, does it matter much? I mean, what does that mean?
That's the thing. It doesn't matter that much. I mean, there are certainly limited ways that the Chief Justice can influence the timing of decisions and certain things like that. The Chief Justice also is a kind of a chief administrative officer of the state court system. So he or she has certain, she in both cases, no matter which Chief Justice you're thinking of at the moment, but so there's limited ability that she has to influence the process. But really, there's a lot of argument going on about a position that really doesn't change the outcome of cases, because that's determined by how the justices themselves vote.
All right, let's talk a little bit about one other topic from this week. We're moving toward a higher speed limit. I guess that matches us with surrounding states. But what was driving that push, Jason or Don? Any thoughts? Do we need to go 70 miles per hour on most highways? Are they built for it? What's the deal?
I think we're already going 70 miles an hour if you go on the highways. But in one sense, I can sort of see why the legislature adopted this, to be in line with other states. But I do wonder, Greg, you raise a good point. The condition of some of the interstate highways where the speed limit will play out are not so great. And Jason, do you think that's an issue of the roadways and people just are already driving fast? What's the difference?
Well, to a certain extent, you're arguing about whether people should be able to drive 75 miles an hour instead of 7, because they're driving 70 right now, right, effectively. Clearly, one factor here is that between Pennsylvania and Washington on the West Coast, it's already every state in the north of the United States is at 70 miles per hour or higher. In some cases, 10 miles an hour higher than that. So Wisconsin was an island of 65 mile per hour speed limits. Republicans decided to change that. It is worth noting, though, that the state DOT will continue to have the ability to decide which stretches of road are going to be marked at a given speed. So they will have the ability to come in and say, because of this is an urban environment, or it's a stretch of highway that is not engineered up to snuff, they will have the ability to keep those stretches at 65.
All right, we're going to close with a reader question here. We had a few come in. I think we have time just for one, and this is something that was in the news, so I'm going to start it with Jason. But this is from a reader whose screen name was Stand Up, which I assume doesn't mean he wants us to stand up. I think it's stand up for something. But it says, Walker preaches being responsible with money. Then we found out he ran up $50,000 on his own credit card. Isn't that inconsistent? And this, give us the background, Jason, and I think the $50,000 is kind of fuzzy, but what's this guy reader referring to, and does it make a difference to voters?
Yeah, the $50,000 is very fuzzy. What the reader is probably being prompted by is the Boston Globe did a story this week about the wealth of all the presidential candidates. That story echoed a finding of a piece that I wrote earlier this month that looked at how most people in the presidential field right now, whether it's Ted Cruz or Hillary Clinton or Lord knows Carly Fiona, they all as a group have wealth that is, far in excess and sometimes hundreds of times greater than the average American. Scott Walker is a real glaring exception to that rule. He's somebody that certainly for most of his life was very much a middle class person, living in homes with two bedrooms and, the whole nine yards, right? But he will be, so that's something that's coming up in the course of the presidential election. We don't really know with great precision what his assets and debts are. All he's got to respond to the state ethics disclosure is that he owes on a couple of credit cards between $5,000 and $50,000. So he is carrying, like many Americans, something he shares with a lot of voters, thousands of dollars of credit card debt. At least he was as of December. It certainly could rise into the tens of thousands of dollars. But when the Boston Globe, I think, picked that number that you're seeing bouncing around the internet, that's a somewhat arbitrary number because we really don't know within that range of debt where his credit card bill is at.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for this week. Next week, we may be talking about a Bucks deal. We may also have to just solve the problems of the Brewers while we're solving problems. Until then, if you want updates on Scott Walker, please check our Scott Walker page, jsonline.com/Scott Walker, and see you next week.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, faucets, vanities, doors, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online now through July 18th. Not a member? Join MyLowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.